first case in our calendar is 96-249, Frank A. Rulli versus Fan Company. Mr. Zimmerman.
To find out, A, whether there was a meeting of specify the price for two businesses. Who's running those businesses now?
The Appellees are running the businesses.
Continue to.
Correct.
Is there an issue that somehow they have not to, and your clients to buy these businesses, right?
Correct.
That's the agreement. Is there some issue that these, the Appellees have not properly run the business in the inner? Maybe you don't seem to raise that.
Well, I have a footnote, Your Honor, in this sense, that one of the issues that was never addressed in this buy-sell agreement is what's the risk of loss between the date of the agreement and the date of closing. You do not have a three-year interval between the date of the alleged agreement and the date of the closing. I see a nightmare of issues arising if this sale is ordered to proceed to closing as to what's happened to those businesses in 3 years. Now, you can take the position, well, that's your fault, you bought down the agreement. But the point is, we never reached, in our mind, we never reached the point where we had an agreement as to close that deal.
Well, what would you have us do? You just want to walk away from the agreement altogether?
Well,
suppose we don't buy into that. What's your plan B?
Right. If the court does not agree that just reading the agreement enables the court to make a decision that there was not a meeting of the minds, our primary relief that we would like from this court is to tell the trial court we have to conduct an evidentiary hearing and determine the issues that are being raised by the appellant. Why is there a meeting of the minds on the essential elements of the enforceable contract?
But you want to go back and have an evidentiary hearing to get out of the agreement. You don't want to have an evidentiary hearing to have the court clear up. Did cash disappear? I saw that you were talking about somebody wanted to take out cash. Well, the cash should have been a fairly fixed item at that point.
Except that there was a disagreement of the parties as to whether cash was included. That's part of the problem.
You buy a corporation, right? And a partnership.
That's the way one party saw it, yes. But your question was, what would we have the court address in the evidence?
Yeah, when I read your brief, I thought your complaint was we just didn't get a chance to present the loose ends, the disagreement, the issues on which we could not agree and have the court resolve those. Today it sounds like you want to have the evidentiary hearing to convince the court that there was no meeting of minds, so you should walk away from the settlement agreement.
Well, what the Court of Appeals...
What's the purpose of the evidentiary hearing?
It would be twofold, Your Honor. It would be, first of all, to determine, was there a meeting of the minds on enough... In other words, point one is, did you have an enforceable contract? And I refer the court to its decision in Erasmus versus Pollock.
So the purpose of the hearing is to convince the court that you should walk on the...
Number one, that would be our first contention that there was not a meeting of minds. Secondly, I guess if there's one thing I would do different in this case is instead of filing a motion to vacate the judgment, I filed the same motion that the appellees did, which was to enforce the judgment, so to enforce it the way I interpreted it. I guess the way the issues were framed made it look like we were trying to walk away from the agreement and the appellees wanted to perform. In fact,
I still get that impression today, so I can see how the...
Well, if we could perform the agreement the way we understood it, of course we'd love to go through with the agreement. I guess my point was trying, at the trial court level, was to say, well, gee, if they think the agreement was this and we think the agreement was this, we're just in different worlds. Well, I should take the approach that, well, yeah, this is the agreement the way I understood it.
I agree with Justice Pfeiffer. It sounds like at the time you asked the court to have a hearing, you intended to have the issues in dispute clarified by the court. In other words, it sounded like you wanted to go through with the settlement, but these issues that were hanging out there, you wanted the court to take care of those. Now it sounds like you want the court to have a hearing on whether or not there is a settlement to begin with and throw it out if he felt there wasn't. Isn't that true?
If the court determines on the basis of the evidence, and we would present evidence that the lawyers
I'm trying to point out simply that at the time you asked the court to have a hearing, it was not on the subject of whether or not there was a settlement. It was on the subject of these loose ends.
No,
is that correct?
It was both. Actually, I filed a motion to vacate the judgment entry, the single line judgment entry saying settlement is material in front of you to have an enforceable agreement.
So from the very get-go, you said that there was no settlement.
That's correct.
The only thing you're asking for in your brief is that there be a hearing. I mean, all these other issues boil down in your brief, it seems to me, that you want us to remand it back, order a hearing over the disputed parts of the agreement.
That's the primary relief.
The agreement was read into the record. Who read it into the record?
To be honest, I read the bulk of it.
Being honest is the best policy. Shouldn't you be bound by what's in the record?
Well, I think that's one of the important issues here, is that is an oral contract where counsel is standing up in front of the court, making a lot with no text in front of him or her, to present an agreement that's been hammered out between counsel in a 30 to 40 minute period, running sort of a show of diplomacy between the clients and one of the attorneys and another. Is that attorney, myself, to be held to a degree of draftsmanship that a party sat down and hammered out a written agreement?
You ever read an agreement into the record before? I did lots of them, and you particularly do it in domestic cases, don't you?
I understand that.
Settlement agreements. And aren't we always bound by what's in the written record?
I would refer the court to a number of its own decisions which have held that where you have an oral agreement, which this was, I mean, it's transcribed, right? It was an oral agreement. That the court can always examine parole evidence to determine what the intent of the parties was. And I think there are some examples, if I could use the primary example in that transcript that is so unclear, is the fight over whether in the partnership the appellant was buying debts and liabilities, or excuse me, assets and liabilities or just assets. In one hand, yes, I said on the record that I was buying, that the appellant was buying the interest of the appellees. But then if you look, we have a fight over the mortgage, and that was allocated separately, that each agreed to pay a third of that. And then counsel for the appellees said on the record, and they'll take care of any other liens or encumbrances. Well, why would they agree to pay for liens and encumbrances on the real property, which was the only asset that the partnership owned, if we were buying the debts? The asset or the debts and encumbrances that are of record are easier to find than the debts that we don't know about. So I think there's a brilliant example of an inconsistency that just by looking at the record, you can see that the parties really didn't make the language match.
You know the court so much, you know the case so much better than we do, but that doesn't sound like an inconsistency to me. Many times we've said, in cases that I've handled, that the one party will indemnify the other for any outstanding obligations. That's a clear thing, isn't that? When I looked at this, is that what that says?
My point is that the Court of Appeals held that in a dispute between what did the appellant buy, debts and assets or just assets, the Court of Appeals said, well, the language you use says you're buying the interest. If you're buying interest, you're buying assets and you're buying liabilities. But on the record, the counsel for the appellee says you're going to pay for any liens or encumbrances on the real estate. Our position was they always agreed to assume the debts of the partnership. We were buying only assets.
Is there anything specific about the corporate name? That's really the reason I voted to take this case in, because we get into that argument all the time. The corporate name, does that come with the assets? Was there anything specific in the agreement about the corporate name?
The language that we relied on for saying that we should get the corporate name was the language that said we had all the assets.
And so if the corporate name is an asset, then you acquire that. You'd have no objection to that.
No, I would use that as a specific example of a term where the parties had completely different expectations of what was going to happen with the language used.
Counsel, as I read the way this got unwound, you actually did get at least the benefit of something with respect to the debts. Each of the other parties was required to take some of the proceeds that you're to pay and to pay off a one-third interest in the mortgage. Is that correct?
There was a specific agreement that the parties would allocate the mortgage one-third, and then there was a statement that the appellees would pay for the liens and encumbrances. Now, I think that clashes with the Court of Appeals holding that the appellant is to pay the debts of the partnership because he might be interested in both debts and assets.
But I thought the way this is working out is the actual real estate mortgage, their third is to each be paid down.
That's With respect to the mortgage, that is correct.
Now, is there something else about all of this, as it sits at this point, that the parties cannot tell how this is to be unwound?
Something, you can hear the other issue?
I mean, if you lost today, will you and the other side be able to tell what you have to do?
I do not believe so. For instance, the covenant not to compete, which was a major issue of contention in the trial court. The trial court just ignored the issue, didn't put anything in its judgment about the covenant not to compete. The Court of Appeals reinserted the covenant not to compete, but didn't address the disagreement between the parties as to how it should be interpreted. So we're right back where we were fighting in front of the trial court about what this is mean.
On page 3 of your brief, you refer to a separate judgment entry in a purchase agreement that was to be prepared after the first hearing, of which you read into the record this rather quickly devised agreement with the seller. I take it from that the trial court, it's your position, the trial court was on sort of a notice that the intention of the parties was that there were details that were to be worked out and to be submitted to the trial court at a later time in the purchase agreement that would cover the issues, that some of the issues that about which you could not agree. Is that correct? And so you came back to the trial court saying we don't have a purchase agreement, essentially we don't have a purchase agreement because we can't agree on the details that I guess we thought we could agree to when we told you we had a settlement. And the trial court said, I'm not going to hold a hearing on that, and ordered you to proceed with the rather cryptic agreement you had.
The trial court essentially said, don't worry about that second agreement. The written agreement that you're going to come back to me with, we'll be back here.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. The case is submitted, and you'll be advised of our opinion.